Recording progress.
Hey, everybody.
But we have looked out over the remaining term, first 2030, for the ETH, and that gets to the number that Warren talked about. During the COVID period, if you recall, HARP reduced its forecast by, I think it was approximately $450 million in mid-2020.
Hi, everybody. I thought just maybe wait for Matt McDermott to join. I don't see him here yet. And Chandra, as far as you know, Matt's going to be joining. Pat, can you guys hear me okay? Okay.
Coming in loud and strong.
Great, thanks. I'm on a borrowed computer, so sometimes not sure. Maybe just wait a couple minutes to see if Matt's going to join. There he is. Okay, great. It looks like the board's all here and SHPD is on, Chandra's on. So I'd like to call this meeting to order. First up is our agenda. I believe that there were two items we originally had on the agenda that have been removed, but one of them was not able to be taken off the agenda. So I believe we need to make a motion to take that off the agenda. Chandra, would you happen to know if the Hawaii Employers Council is just being completely removed, or is it going to be deferred until the next meeting?
Yeah,
or Julia, would you happen to know? Okay, well, I guess we'll just take it off the agenda, and we'll see
Yeah,
what.
I'll move to defer it without giving a specific date.
Okay.
Why do we know why? Because I haven't heard anything about that, and I'm sitting here ready to present it.
Okay, sorry, that's the information that I got from Chandra, that they were going to remove Hawaii Employers Council and.
Ryan, can you speak to that?
Good morning. This is Ryan Tam from Hart. I actually have no knowledge, and we were planning to present it, to my knowledge.
Okay. I guess then we'll just leave it on for now, and if we find out any further information between now and when you do your presentation, then we'll address it then. So we'll leave that on for now. Okay. I think the other motion that we would like to make is to add the discussion for the limited meeting for the March meeting to the end of the agenda. So if somebody could make a motion just to add that discussion. Any of the.
I move that we place the discussion of limited meeting at the end of our agenda.
Okay, thank you, Pat.
Okay, I'll second that.
Yes. Okay. Thank you, Paul. All in favor of adding that to the agenda? Alton? Okay, great. Thanks, all in favor. Any opposed or comments? Okay, moving on. Is there any other suggested changes to the agenda that any of the board members have? Okay, then can we have a motion to approve the agenda as amended?
So moved.
Thank you, Bill.
Second.
Okay, all 10 seconds. All in favor of accepting the revised agenda? Okay, all in favor. Thank you. Next for discussion is the meeting minutes. Anybody have any changes that need to be made? Any suggested revisions? Okay, can I have a motion to approve the meeting minutes for the August 5th meeting?
So moved.
I'll move to approve.
Yep.
I'll second.
Okay, thank you. Bill moves and Alton seconds. All in favor of accepting the meeting minutes for August 5th meeting. Okay, all approved, all in favor. Thank you. Then we can move on to the first nomination, the Hawaii Employers Council. Just wanted to confirm from Chandra or Julia that there was no reason that we needed to remove this from the agenda.
I'd like a clarification, Chairperson. This is Michelle Mattson.
Okay, I'm sorry, hold on a second. I need to answer this phone call and talk with Chandra. She's okay, sorry about that. I just got confirmation from SHPD that it's actually the owner that is requesting that it be removed from this meeting. I don't know any further if they wanted to move it to the next meeting or just completely remove it, but the owner of the Hawaii Employers Council is asking to have this removed from today's agenda.
Again, Ryan, can you speak to this?
No, I mean, I would defer to Shifty and, you know, Hart. Again, all these nominations that we're considering today is just for our requirements that HART is trying to fulfill as part of its Section 106 programmatic agreement. Again, we have no other intention other than to fulfill our requirements. And so, you know, we would certainly defer to SHPTE if they want to remove it or defer it. We will follow their lead.
Yeah, and from what I understand, it's actually not SHPTE that's choosing to do this. It's at the owner's request that the owner sent a letter to SHPTE to have it asked for it to be removed from today's agenda. So I guess going forward, SHPTE can determine whether they want to put this back on the agenda for possibly the next meeting or another meeting. So, yeah.
Okay.
Great.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Katie, could I get a point of clarification on this? I know that owner permission is required for listing on the National Register, but identifying it as eligible, isn't that something that SHPD can do?
Yeah, I believe that's correct. So I'm not sure whether we are required to review this nomination. But at the same time, I think that the owner can request that it not be reviewed. I'm sorry, I think SHPTE's going to have to weigh in on this.
I don't know if Alan's here or not, but there used to be a determination of eligibility form.
Yeah, and that's actually not what we'd be looking at today. It would actually be the nomination.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, and this is a mitigation for the HART project, and mitigation actually requires a National Register nomination, which is why we've been doing this for the last couple years. So this is actually going to have to be resolved, I believe, between HART and the owner.
Correct.
Angie, do you know if a determination of eligibility would stand in your contract on this or your memorandum of agreement on this? Does a D of eligibility DOE form satisfy yes. that requirement? Okay.
Yes, that was done well before this phase.
Okay, well, it sounds like with no further instruction from SHPD at this time, we'll just need to defer it for now or just remove it from today's agenda until they can work out what the requirements would be. I think so. Chandra said that she was having some difficulty with her audio. I don't know. Julia, are you able to make a comment?
She had put in the chat if anybody could hear her, and I couldn't hear her, so I think she's having the same issue.
Madam Chair, to remove it from the agenda, even temporarily, I believe we need a motion to do so.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, that's what I thought we were doing at the beginning of the meeting, but since the presenters weren't notified. Okay, would somebody like to make a motion to just remove it from today's agenda?
So moved.
Okay. Thank you, Bill and Paul. Second. Okay. Thank you. Okay. All in favor of just removing this from today's agenda? Okay. All in favor. Thank you. And Chandra is saying that she's sorry that her audio is not working, but she's resending the email that SHPTE received from the owner requesting that it be taken out of the agenda. So we can address this further, I think, at our next meeting, or if we get some more information by the end of today's meeting. Okay, thank you. We'll just move on to the next item on the agenda, which is the Merchant Street Commercial and Civic and Historic District as amended. Will that be you, Angie?
Yes, except I've lost everything. There we go. Okay, I just need to share my screen. Host disabled participant screen sharing.
Sandra, can you enable her to share screen, please?
There we go. Is that good? Everybody can see it and hear me?
Okay. We hear you in the far distance.
Oh, okay. Computer closer and try to remember if I put
That's
my
better.
Space back
That's
in
better.
And move it back. Okay. Okay, so this is the Merchant Street Historic District, additional documentation and boundary increase. The amended National Register of Historic Places form was prepared as mitigation for the Honolulu Rail Transit Project. The original Merchant Street District nomination was completed in 1973, I think by Don, or maybe just the letter was. Since submitting this nomination to SHPDI, we have consulted with the National Park Service on the proper naming of amended nominations. Their current guidance is to retain the original name, but add in parentheses the nature of the amended changes, hence the new name you see here as compared to what you saw, what you read that was provided to you by SHPDI. I haven't given them this updated name just in case we have comments that need to be addressed today. So anyway, so that this is the proper name according to NPS. The list of architects of these buildings include Dickey, Kerr, Ripley, Trapagan, Hartwood, and a whole bunch of others. The styles range from Italianate to Mission to Mediterranean to Beaux-Arts, Spanish Mission Revival, Classical Revival. It's quite a mishmash of styles from the early 1900s. And the dates of construction span from 1836 to 1854. 1836 is the original Honolulu Hali that's no longer extant as a building, but is a site. And so the oldest extant building is the Melchers Building, which is 1854. The Merchant Street Historic District is in downtown Honolulu. Merchant Street's alignment is slightly curved and runs north, northwest to south, southeast along the Mackay end of downtown. The entire street is only six blocks long, extending from Nu'uanu Avenue to Mililani Street, with the historic district occupying the three innermost blocks. The district is discontinuous. It begins at the intersection of Nu'uanu and Marin Streets and extends along Merchant Street to the site of the original Honolulu Hali, which is now a commemorative park, like I just said. The district continues south of Fort Street and includes only buildings on the Mackay side of Merchant Street. The district boundaries exclude the Oceanit Building, Pioneer Plaza, American Savings Bank, and the Bank of Hawaii Building. These boundaries were selected to follow and expand upon the original 1973 nomination and clarifying the 1976 boundaries. And it includes groupings of historic low to mid-rise buildings and objects that convey a sense of the early years of downtown Honolulu. In its early days, Merchant Street's proximity to Honolulu Harbor made it a prime location to store the goods that ships brought to the islands, as well as sell goods to restock and repair visiting ships. It's not going. There we go. The Kamehameha V Post Office was built in 1871, and in addition to being the first building in Hawaii to be constructed of reinforced concrete, it was also the state's first standalone post office. Early Merchant Street was also home to taverns, brothels, stables, attorneys and doctor's offices, newspapers, and a few residences. By the early 1900s, Merchant Street was garnering a reputation as Honolulu's Wall Street, the location of Honolulu's stock exchange, banks, insurance companies, sugar factors, and commission agents. Merchant Street was where the economic, political, and social power of Hawaii came to be concentrated during the territorial period. The following are the contributing resources of the Merchant Street Historic District. This is the T.R. Foster Building, located on the northwest corner of Nu'uanu Avenue and Marin Street. Though technically not on Merchant Street, the building is part of the Merchant Street corridor and is representative of both the period and the style of buildings within the district. It is a two-story, six-bay Italianate building with a ground floor storefront, typical of the late 19th century. The building is topped by a stepped parapet roof with an elaborate cornice. Behind the T.R. Foster building, facing Marin Street, is a simple single-story red brick storage building. The front facade has two recessed arched windows that may have originally been doors. The building has a decorative brick parapet with a simple brick cornice and pediment along the front facade. The small warehouse is part of the same parcel as the T.R. Foster building, but has been counted as a separate building for this nomination and the 73 as well. The Royal Saloon. The Italianate Royal Saloon was erected shortly after the 1889 widening of Merchant Street. It's a single-story brick building with Victorian Gothic decorative elements and a clipped corner entrance facing the intersection. The cornice features large dentils and is topped by a solid roofline balustrade with engaged balusters. All three of these buildings fall within both the Chinatown Historic District and the Merchant Street Historic District as of right now. The J.T. Waterhouse building is located next to Royal Saloon. The two-story Mission Revival style building was erected in 1870 and remodeled in 1911 to 1914. We're not sure exactly. The second story is defined by two parallel belt courses, above which is a Mission style parapet. The Yokohama Specie Bank building at the northwest corner of Merchant and Bethel Streets is an ornate two-story Beaux-Art style building constructed in 1908. The fireproof brick and steel building features many terracotta decorative elements and is one of the more elaborate buildings within the district. The bank building served as Honolulu's Japanese community until the day after the attack on Pearl Harbor, when all Japanese-owned businesses in Hawaii were ordered closed by Governor Poindexter. Japanese property throughout the territory was seized by the alien property custodian and liquidated or repurposed. The Yokohama Specie Bank was used at that time to store those confiscated goods, and the basement was used during the war as a lockup for drunk soldiers. The Yokohama Specie Bank did not reopen in Hawaii after the war. The building was sold in 1954 and leased to the City of Honolulu for use as a traffic citation bureau, and it has been sold several times since and is currently an early learning center. The Friend Building is a two-story brick and stucco commercial building that sits next to Yokohama Specie Bank on Bethel Street. The second floor's facade has six evenly spaced segmental arch openings with inset windows. Above the window is a stepped dental course and dual pediment. The northeast pediment reads The Friend, 1887, while the left pediment is unadorned. You can see that here. The Friend building was home to Hawaii's oldest continuously published periodical, The Friend of Temperance and Seamen, founded in 1843. The Friend is considered the oldest newspaper west of the Rockies. The newspaper has continued to the present, albeit in different formats under the auspices of various religious groups, and is thus the oldest newspaper in the Pacific. The old Honolulu Police Station, now called the Walter Murray Gibson Building, was erected in 1931 to replace an earlier police station building that had been demolished for the extension of Bethel Street. The Spanish eclectic style building occupies the entire block along Merchant Street from Nu'uanu to Bethel. It is 3 and 4 stories tall and built of concrete covered in stucco with a barrel tile roof. The main entry at the corner of Merchant and Bethel, the main entry is at the corner of Merchant and Bethel and features a matching dual corner entryways with large intricately carved wooden paneled double doors with a solid paneled surround. The grand terracotta surround, also the same on both elevations, reaches to the fourth floor. The King Kamehameha V Post Office Building is the second oldest building in the district and the first in Honolulu to be built entirely of precast concrete. The exterior walls of the building are rusticated to appear to be cut stone. This neoclassical building's main facade fronts Merchant Street and features a deep rounded portico set on a podium that is encircled by a short concrete balustrade with multiple openings leading onto the platform where the mail was distributed. You can see the mailboxes here. The current footprint is larger than the original and includes a circa 1900 brick rear addition with cement plaster detailing to match the cut stone finish of the original. The Milchers Building was built in 1854 at the then prominent corner of Merchant and Kahumanu Streets. The Milchers Building is the oldest extant building within the Merchant Street District, as well as the oldest extant commercial building in Honolulu. It is also the only building within the district constructed of coral block, which can be seen at the rear elevation. Right there, you can see that's the back. But the coral texture and many of the design details have been obscured by multiple layers of paint and stucco. The building also has a basement, which was uncommon in buildings so close to the harbor. What happened? Here we go. Note that the first floor windows were originally loading doors. The Bishop Bank Building, renamed the Harriet Blusog Building, is at the other corner of Merchant and what was Kaʻumanu Streets. Kaʻumanu was converted to a pedestrian walkway in 1931 when the city extended Bethel Street from Merchant to Queen. The two-story Bishop Bank Building was originally a mix of Renaissance, Revival, Italianate, and Second Empire styles. It originally featured a mansard roof and delicate roofline cresting. At the clipped corner, the parapet is interrupted by an arched pediment with 1877 in bold numbers on the tympanum. This date block is not original and is likely part of a 2010 renovation. The original block, as you can see in the other picture, read Bishop and Company and was within a similar but much more ornate corner pediment that included spire finials that was part of the mansard roof. The Bishop Estate Building, directly adjacent to the Bishop Bank Building, not only had interior connections at the time of construction, but it also had no sidewalls of its own, sharing walls with the Bishop Bank Building and the Campbell Building. The small Richardson Romanesque style building is the only building within the historic district with the basalt. That's why I was confused. It's the little picture, not the corner picture, the little building next to it. Anyway, it's the only one within the district with lava rock facade, but this is it currently. Next, we have the Judd Block, built in 1899. Was built on another prominent corner, that of Merchant and Fort Streets. The refined Beaux Arts Building is 5 stories tall with a clipped corner facing that former major intersection. These are just 2 different, very similar photos. The ground floor facade has been significantly altered in the original design, whereas the 2nd through 4th floors remain almost intact. A 5th floor was added to the Judd Building sometime between 1914 and 1927. And in the 70s, this 5th floor was converted into a solarium, which you can see in this picture. Next, we have the Stangenwald Building, directly adjacent to the Judd Building, built in 1901. It has a steel frame with masonry bearing walls and a concrete foundation, a construction method that was brand new to Hawaii at the time. The 6-story Renaissance Revival office building with Italianate detailing is one of the larger buildings in the district and is considered Hawaii's first skyscraper. It was the tallest office building in the Hawaiian Territory until the 1950s. It was considered downtown Honolulu's It was also considered downtown Honolulu's first fireproof building. The Honolulu Star Bulletin Building, is a small two-story building that has been significantly altered from its original 1910 design. At the time of construction, the building was a blend of Beaux Arts and Italian Renaissance architecture. Currently, the facade blends design elements from various revival styles. The building remains significant because it conveys the size and scale that was common in the Merchant Street Historic District during the period of significance. And the Alexander and Baldwin Building. It's one of the grandest buildings within the Merchant Street District. Fronting Bishop Street with minor facades on both Merchant and Queen Street, it marks the southern boundary of this historic district. The four-story reinforced concrete building was designed by C.W. Dickey in partnership with Hart Wood and is the only building in the Merchant Street Historic District to have a gable-on-hip style roof, which has been become synonymous with Dickey's work. Stylistically, the Alexander and Baldwin Building is a unique blend of Chinese and Western elements with Asian-influenced Hawaiian motifs. Okay, now we're moving in away from the buildings and into some of the other features. The Honolulu Hale site is adjacent to the CAM 5 post office and is a small park that's the site of the original Honolulu Hale, which this is a picture. Commissioned by King Kamehameha III in 1836, as you can see, it was a two-story Monterey-style coral block building with a two-story covered veranda and four rooms on each floor. The building was leased for government use in 1843 to the Customs Office. It also became the Treasury Department, the Department of Interior, the Department of Foreign Affairs, and the Post Office for the territory. Construction of the adjacent Kamehameha V Post Office in 1871 and the planned construction of the much larger Honolulu Hale on King Street in 1928 led to the building's abandonment and eventual sale and demolition in 1917. It appears from historic photos and maps that the site has remained an open space since the district's period of significance. In 1976, the Outdoor Circle and the Garden Club of Honolulu began beautification efforts, and today the site is a commemorative space with multiple dedication paths. The park shares a TMK property boundary with the CAM 5 post office and is unlikely to ever be developed. This is showing you the first picture, I guess on your left, is showing you the location of the lava rock and the granite curbs within the district. The lava rock curbs, which are the blue, are prevalent throughout the Merchant Street Historic District. The curbs were first installed in the early 1890s and continued to be installed well into the 1960s. Lava rock curbs were crafted from local resources and are an extremely distinctive feature of late 19th to mid 20th century urban Honolulu. The stones for the granite curbs and sidewalks is less common, and those are the yellow ones. And these were likely brought to the islands as ships' ballasts from Europe and Asia. Within the Merchant Street Historic District, the granite curbs were cut to similar sizes as the lava rock curbs. And we have the cannons. Two historic 24-pounder cast iron cannons are located within the district on the Merchant and Bethel Street sides of the CAM 5 post office. The two cannons are placed vertically in the poured concrete sidewalk and flank the pedestrian access ramp at the intersection of those two streets. This is the most common heavy caliber gun in the 19th century, and they range from 6 to 10 feet in length, and we have no idea exactly how far into the concrete these cannons are, so we don't really know their length. And here we have the Campbell block remnant. You can see it right here. I'm sure you're all familiar with it. And this is the best picture I could find of the actual building over here. There's not very many pictures of this building, but it's located between the Bishop Estate building and the Oceanet building on Merchant Street. And it's the remnant, like I said, of the Campbell block, which was built in 1882. This 19-inch wide two-story strip is all that remains of the building, which was demolished in 1965 to build the new adjacent building. That section of the cannon block was left in situ because it's a load-bearing wall for the adjacent Bishop Estate building, and it would have, which would have been heavily damaged if it had been removed. The two-story strip is a plaster-covered brick facade, of which approximately 15 inches of the 19-inch wide width of it is a cast iron and concrete concrete plaster pilaster. That's a tongue twister. Right there. Okay. The Merchant Street Historic District is significant at the state level under criteria A and C. Under criteria A, it is Honolulu's best example of an early commercial center in post-contact, pre-territorial and territorial Hawaii. It is one of the first official streets in Hawaii and the city's first economic hub. Under criterion C, Merchant Street houses a notable concentration of intact historic commercial and municipal buildings dating from the mid-19th to the mid-20th century. I'm going to go ahead and go, even though that's a lot to read. Changes in this nomination from the 1973 nomination include the addition of buildings. And you did that. Oh, wait. Oh, that's what I was doing. Let me go back. How do I go back? And it doesn't matter. Anyway, changes in the nomination from the 1973 include the addition of the buildings you see here, the site, and the street objects. The history of the area and descriptions of the contributing resources have been expanded upon. Another change that was made to the nomination that you guys read was per a suggestion from the Hart Kakoʻo Group and Historic Hawaii Foundation. We have updated, do I have it? Did I put it? No, I didn't put it in there. We've updated the table that's within the nomination that you've seen to show which buildings within the district are also individually listed on the register. So that table just has some little asterisks on it now that shows you which buildings within the district are individually listed. And that is it.
Thank you, Angie.
Share.
We wanted to move on for questions for Angie. I just wanted to first start with asking why when you were reading the criteria that it was eligible under, you didn't mention criteria D, even though it was on your screen with the text.
Why I didn't mention it? Because I forgot.
Okay.
So it's still included. it's eligible under D. I thought I had added that. Anyway, it's eligible for D for the Honolulu Hale site.
Yeah.
Primarily. Okay.
I mean, it was up on the screen in the text, but then you just said A and C and you didn't, as far as
because
I recall.
Because I somehow forgot it in my notes. Okay. Sorry about that. Thank you for noticing that.
Still in there. Okay. Other questions for Angie from the board?
I have a few. Angie, first of all, thank you. That was really an enjoyable trip through Hawaii's history. That's quite different from what we often get. And I want to compliment you on the thoroughness of everything you presented. A couple of quick just questions. You say that you've added the Honolulu Hale to, it's not an element within the district, is it? Or are you?
No.
Okay. You just added
no, just
it to
the site.
Narrative.
Yeah, okay. That's the site.
But it doesn't have status as a contributing something.
Yeah, it has status as a contributing site because of primarily D, like Katie mentioned, that I forgot to mention.
Would there be any, this is a question maybe for Matt, would there be anything left to make it constitute an archaeological site where it could reveal additional information?
Yeah, there certainly could. You know, we'd have to do some background research to see how the demolition took place and, you know, potentially do some GPR work, ground penetrating radar excavations. But, you know, based on prior work in Chinatown, similar buildings, there'd probably be something left that would make it significant under criterion D.
I wonder if that needs to be clarified in the narrative part that it possesses potential for further research rather than simply saying criteria criterion D. I don't know.
It does say that in the nomination.
It does? Okay.
Yes, it does. I'm sorry that I didn't mention it in my presentation.
Okay. A quick just question again on the curves. So if you have the volcanic rock curbs, do you have the volcanic rock paving too?
Those are just curbs.
Only curbs. So you'll have a combination of basaltic curbs with the Chinese granite pavers, right?
Yes.
And the way you spoke of it, it implied that they were somehow cut here, but presumably they were cut in China, right?
The granite? No, I believe those were cut here.
Really? I thought they came over as pavers that way, which is what meant why they're so uniform everywhere. I thought they came from China that way.
That's not something that I've ever come across. But we did come across the fact that they were cut to match the basalt curbs, which is why we just assumed that they were cut here.
The curbs part, but I'm talking about the pavers.
Oh, the pavers. The pavers could have been pre-cut that size, absolutely. I thought you were talking about
You can see them over on Kapahulu by Hawaiian dredging still, and you can see them in the Honolulu Museum of Art.
It's highly likely that those were that size because they were used as ballast. So, yes. I misunderstood.
Did you mention that the Campbell Estate building, I may have missed this part, the remnant piece is cast iron. Did you say that? Or did you say so? Okay. Mm-hmm. And let's see, one other. Do you have any idea when they embedded the cannons there on the corner?
They've been there a long time, because if you look at those old pictures I had from 1900, they were there.
And so, that's interesting. I was just wondering what the earliest picture you had that had them in it. But
I think the thank you slide, which even showed them there, the little colorized picture from 1900. So I'm guessing that they put those there when they built the Camp 5 post office. But we don't have any real proof of that.
I guess my intuitive thought would be they put it in when you had motorized traffic. As bollards to prevent running into the corner. But that could be quite early too, like 1967. One quick suggestion, and I don't know if other people think this should be added, but we're trying to bring the Hawaiian story more into everything. John Papa'i'i's book describes the area of Merchant Street as having been an o'o'i'i field. It was a place where they practiced spear throwing and other martial arts in the period, even into the early period of colonial presence. So I wonder if that we wouldn't like to have that mentioned. I think it's very interesting to think that they followed the course of an older element there in downtown Honolulu. So I just call it to everybody's attention. I don't know if we want to start thinking of that more.
We do mention that area was, part of an early settlement. They used that land, but not that specific information. I haven't heard that.
Yeah,
but it could easily be incorporated.
Paul Rockwood's map that he did following the publication of John Papa'i'i's 1910, the description of Honolulu in 1810 shows that as an o'o'i'i, which is interesting, I think. So, like in Boston, it was like cow paths, and here it was maybe something Hawaiian that kind of determined the direction and layout of the thing. And so, when I was starting out giving presentations, I once said, I was talking about the curvature of a column, and I said entasis, and a good friend of mine corrected me later, said it's entasis. You have no way of knowing, but I'm going to tell you, in 1920, H.L. Mencken wrote a book about the South called The Sierra of the Bozarts, the Bozarts. So that is how you pronounce Bozar. You've given a Z sound to the X, just for the future. When you keep saying Beaux Arts, but it's Beaux Arts.
Okay, sorry.
I thought you'd appreciate it, not take it as a criticism.
No, like no. Yeah, actually, you said that to me before, and I did not remember.
Just remember, Sierra of the Bozarts. He spelled it B-O-Z-A-R-T-S. So then if you remember Bose, that way you get the Z in there.
Got it.
All right. Those are my questions and comments. I don't know if anybody else wants to build on anything I suggested.
Yeah. Any other questions from the board for Angie? Go ahead, Pat.
Thanks, Angie. Yes, it was a really interesting presentation. You mentioned that that there are some buildings in this amended nomination that are in the Chinatown Historic District, and that makes a lot of sense. Will they continue to be? Is the Chinatown District going to also be amended?
We had a meeting on that not too long ago, and I think we all decided as a group with Hart and the Kokoʻo group, and that's who it was with, that an overlap didn't hurt anything. So I think they will stay. And yes, you will. I believe you will be seeing Chinatown maybe in the first meeting of next year, if not that, probably the second.
Okay.
But we're not doing that, so don't hold me to it.
I won't haunt your dreams if it doesn't matter. the other thing, how is the rail affecting this district? You know, that it needs mitigation, the amendment.
Well, the rail is going down Nimitz and Ala Moana. And then right at the Dillingham Transportation Building, it goes down Halekuʻila. So it's not as close as it is to a lot of the other things we presented. So, but it's still within an area of potential effect that it needed to be documented.
Yeah, I can see that. And also affect the Malka to Mackay viewplane as well.
Exactly, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Pat. Any other questions from the board for Angie? Okay, anybody else in the audience have any questions for Angie? Okay, thanks. Would anybody like to make a motion?
I move to, what would you say, accept the revision to the 1973? Nomination of the, is it 1973, Angie?
Mm-hmm.
1973 Merchant Street nomination to include additional properties as designated on the accompanying maps for under criterion A, C, and D.
Thank you, Bill. Any second?
A second.
Okay, thank you, Paul. Okay, any further discussion? The only thing I had, Angie, was that there's at least two places where it mentions that two buildings are to be added to the nomination, which is the Alexander and Baldwin building and another one, I think. And it points out that those buildings are already listed on the National Register of Historic Places. I thought you could possibly add that they're also on the Hawaii Register. So just say these buildings are on the Hawaii Register and the National Register.
Okay.
Yeah, it's the Stangenwald was the other building.
Right, okay.
But there's quite a few of them, actually, that are listed on both.
Yeah, but there's some text that says, you know, we're adding two buildings, which are, you know, these two buildings, and these two buildings are listed on the National Register. So I just thought you could add in that they're also on the Hawaii Register. Okay.
I hate to throw in another quick question, if I could, Caden.
Sure.
The Star Bulletin Building is listed on the State Register, I believe, right? Is this now going to be a contributing building on the National Register?
Yes. It's, I mean, if it's part of this.
Reason I bring it up, I was there at the time when they nominated it. And I mean, actually, the understanding at the time on the vote was that it was clearly not eligible for the National Register. But at that point, the board thought sort of things of lesser significance or lesser integrity could be put on the State Register. I wasn't
Okay, I'm following
it. It got listed as a State Register. Now, I will remind you, this was something done by someone else in your office. There was a promise by the owner that they would restore the facade to its original appearance at the time of the nomination.
Oh, really?
It was a verbal promise, which is what carried the, which what carried it over the threshold. And they clearly did not do that, which is why I think now we never do take people at their word. But there was a verbal promise.
They were going to
restore that facade, and that's what we accepted so that it would be eligible for the State Register. So it is a little bit problematic under, you know, for investment tax credit purposes and other things if it's now going to be a contributing building.
Right. And I did mention in my presentation, and it says in the nomination, that it's a contributing resource to this district primarily for its size and scale, not really for its facade.
So if this came up as an ITC project, would they be eligible? Would they get their Part 1 certification?
They would not be eligible for Hawaii tax credits. I can't speak to, you know, any kind of other
program.
Yeah, I'm
just worried about the federal one, like what we did, what we saw at the Patagonia shop over there on Ward Avenue, because they're getting investment tax credit to help pay for it. So you see what I mean? It's been a kind of slippery slope where we said it's not really eligible. Oh, he's going to restore the facade. All right, we'll make it a State Register. Now it seems like through the back door, they're now becoming a contributing structure within the district, which would then make them, again, eligible for the investment tax credit project.
Right. And if they want to do the investment tax credit, I would hope that whoever's doing that would make them fulfill their previous promise.
No, you usually don't. Luckily, ITC doesn't let them get away with that. You can't.
Yeah, exactly. They're very stringent.
They don't. You can't do it on the basis of even a promise to restore a facade.
Yeah, all I'm saying is
you have to have enough there to be eligible. And I don't know if there's enough there to be eligible. I don't know if just saying the bulk of the shape of the building is enough to make it eligible. Because something that's a contributing building within a historic district has to be meet all the criteria for individual eligibility. Anyway, it's a problem in the future.
Well, it meets under A. It may not meet under C, but it definitely meets under A. So, you know, there's that too. A building.
Yeah, but
right?
You still have to have integrity. You have to have integrity for the period. So it doesn't have much.
Bill, I do think this is an issue the board should resolve now. Because if the board approves this nomination saying this is a contributing feature or contributing building, then it's eligible for the tax credit.
I don't think we need to, Alan. It'll have to go through another review. The Part 1 will be reviewed by the Park Service. And if they feel that it was not a contributing building, they will overturn it then.
Because this currently we're just amending this for the Hawaii State Register, and then this will have to be, if they'd like to, before it onto the National Register, who would also review this, correctly?
Yeah, the National Register, in my experience, I did 2 years at this, we overrule the inventory that's presented with the historic districts if we find that one of the buildings that was thought to be contributing isn't contributing.
So in that case, if this nomination was put forward to the National Register and they declined it because of the one structure, would then the previous nomination form and the previous district nomination still hold for the National Register property?
I don't think they would decline it for the one structure. I think it would wait till the time when the person applies for the investment tax credit, and then its contributing status would be more reviewed more closely.
Dr. Downer, do you agree with that?
I agree in principle with Bill. I do think that, you know, that the Park Service I mean, look, the Park Service got hollowed out during the last administration, and they are under enormous pressure to complete these reviews. And they simply don't have the people to do it. So, you know, under the regulations, you know, if they don't act in a timely fashion, in other words, if they receive a nomination and it sits there for 45 days, it goes on if they can't get to it. So, you know, I mean, I think it's, you know, I think the board needs to do what it believes is the right thing. You know, we'll deal with our buddies at the Park Service the best way we can, but I don't think the board should be constrained by what it does or does not anticipate that the keeper will do.
I agree. I think with you, Alan. I think there are other things that are contingent factors. The interior of the building is surprisingly intact. And since it is just a large open printing warehouse at one point, and there's been additions in there, but they're easily removable, just like they were, say, from the building that Patagonia took over. But so I would say we leave it as contributing and hope that it just stay that way. And maybe we will get an enlightened donor who will take that investment tax credit money and actually put it to the end that they previously promised.
Excuse me, Madam Chair, I need to drop off this call for about 45 minutes to meet with the Navy. So I will be back shortly.
I'm suggesting we stick with it.
Okay, any other discussion from the board? Okay, looks like we'll just leave it as is. Like to take a vote, please. Those in favor of placing this onto the this amended version onto the Hawaii Register. All in favor? Okay, looks like a unanimous yes. Thank you, Angie.
Thank you.
Sorry, next on our agenda, we have the Irwin Memorial Park. I wanted to ask, does anybody on the board would like to have a quick break before? Just raise your hand if you'd like a quick break. Okay, we'll just move forward. Next is Irwin Memorial Park. Is that also you, Angie?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Give me a second here to... Where was it? Oh, shoot, can't do that. Okay, this is back to you. Share screen. Share screen. Sorry, I always have to fight the Zoom to get out of the controls for the PowerPoint. There we go. Okay. Irwin Park additional documentation nomination. This is the HART-initiated nomination as mitigation for the rail project as well. Irwin Park is a triangular landscape park and plaza at the southern terminus at Fort Street Mall. It was first created in 1934 with the construction of the Honolulu Harbor. Hold on one second, I'm sorry. Okay, yeah. I'm having a little problem with Irwin Park and Walker Park, keeping them separate in my head. So sorry about that. See, this just isn't right. Anyway, landscape architects associated with the park include Catherine and Robert Thompson and Richard Tong. See, this just isn't right. I don't have the right printout here. I'm going to have to open something up. I'm sorry, guys. This is my mistake. My script is missing.
Angie, would you like us to take a quick 5-minute break and come back?
Yeah, if you don't mind. I'm so sorry. Okay. I printed out the wrong thing.
Okay. So 5 minutes, everybody. We'll come right back.
Chair Stevens, Chairperson Stevens.
I think she stepped away.
Oh, I'd like to ask a question. This is Michelle Mattson.
Mm-hmm.
We have from 3 to 5 testifiers. When would that opportunity be provided to testify on this?
After I finish my presentation, I believe.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Alton and Pat, are you back?
Yes.
Thanks, Pat.
You ready for me to go ahead?
Yeah, I think I might as well. Alton can just join when he gets back.
Okay, you're going to have to bear with me. I'm going to have to read this off my phone now. Okay. All right, there we are. Okay, as I mentioned, this is also mitigation for the HART project. Irwin Park is a triangular landscape park and plaza at the southern terminus of Fort Street Mall. First created in 1934 and updated in 1965. Landscape architects associated with it are Catherine and Robert Thompson, and Richard Tong, and somebody that can only be identified as WCV. It's an urban park and parking lot located at Honolulu Harbor, south-southwest of downtown Honolulu. The site was originally bounded by Fort Street, Halikawila, Bishop Street, and Ala Moana Boulevards. I can't read this one. Basically, what it says is the creation of Nimitz Highway in 1952 lopped off about an acre at the top end of the park. And the previous EVA terminus of Ala Moana Boulevard, along with the section of Fort Street Mall to make Nimitz Highway. And then Halikawila was renamed Aloha Tower Drive. The land, and yes, as you can see here, it's going to be directly adjacent to a downtown, the downtown station for the HART Rail project. The land on which Irwin Park now stands was created during the first Honolulu Harbor Development Project, which was completed in 1870. What had been mostly mudflats and beach was converted into fill where the heavy industry and shipping related businesses were established. And you can see here all the buildings that were on that site. The area that comprised the Irwin Park was then home to blacksmith shops, wagon builders, planing mill, ice works, boat builder, and several storage sheds, as you can see from this 1927 Sanborn map. By the turn of the century, shipping had evolved from sails to steam, and Honolulu Harbor needed larger and more modern wharves to accommodate the larger ships. In 1929, the land for the park was purchased by Mrs. Helen Irwin Fagan, daughter of deceased sugar magnate William G. Irwin, and donated to the territory for use as a park named in honor of her father. And this is what it looked like in 1930. The construction of Pier 8, 9, 10, and 11 terminal complex began in 1919 and was completed in 1927. The complex formed an irregular U shape of, an irregular U shape of two-story concrete passenger and freight terminals. All the buildings in the adjacent block were to be torn down, and the lot would provide space for automobiles as well as grass and palm trees. Clearing the block took several years. The last structure on the site was demolished in 1932, and the park was officially opened in 1934 and named Irwin Memorial Park. Multiple designs had been presented for Irwin Park. Local landscape architects Catherine Richards and Robert Thompson proposed a plan with elaborate tree cover and organic walkways, but without parking. The Board of Honolulu Harbor Commissioners drew up a plan for the park that was almost exclusively parking, but that plan did not comply with Irwin Fagan's stipulations for the green space. A third plan, attributed to a designer known only as WCV on the plans, blended the organic lines of Richards Thomas' plan with the functionality of the Harbor Commission's plan, creating a park that was half parking lot, half landscaped lawn. The design was not a park in the traditional sense, but it served the purpose of Honolulu's harbor gateway to the city. Passengers arriving by boat at the piers exited the terminals to see the park's wide tropical landscape lawns. Behind a broad screen of palm trees was a tree-covered parking lot of six rows with parking stalls divided by landscape strips and protected from traffic along the adjacent streets by a, by a barrier of monkey pod trees. Irwin Park's dual purpose both beautified the waterfront and facilitated automobile transportation to and from the piers. Following the attack on Pearl Harbor, Tower, the pier complex, and Irwin Park were sequestered by the U.S. military. During this time, Irwin Park was slightly altered. The coconut tree arbors that had marked vehicular entrances to the park were removed, and numerous palms from the land side of the park. After the war, the park was returned to public use. And I'm missing information again. Sorry, I don't think I've screwed up this bad before. Hold on. Need to talk about Tong. Here we go. Irwin Park was modified again in the early 1960s after a large passenger terminal was built atop the buildings of Pier 8 and 9, and a vehicular ramp was constructed over Pier 7 to the upper terminal. HDOT Harbors Division contracted Richard C. Tong, a prominent Hawaii landscape architect, to prepare a landscape master plan for Irwin Park. Tong's plan proposed changes to the entire site, including removal of parking and a connection to the new terminal. As with the previous iterations, only a portion of the plan was adopted. When the work was completed in 1965, most of the existing parking was retained and only Tong's pedestrian promenade water feature and planter walls at the park's Evans side were built. This promenade was in alignment with the second story terminal's twin escalators and connected Irwin Park to the new passenger terminal. The next project at the terminals were for the Aloha Tower Marketplace developed in 1994. This multi-phased project included demolition of Piers 8 and 9 and the development of retail shops and restaurants. At this time, work at the park was relatively minimal and included additional lighting, signage, automated turnstiles at the parking lots, entrance, and exit points. Okay. The 1965 walkway runs Mauka to Makai along the north-northwestern side of the park and occupies about one-fifth of the total land area. The pedestrian walkway is distinctly mid-century and is comprised primarily of smooth cast poured concrete. The walkway itself is an elongated trapezoidal shape, and the walkway narrows slightly as it continues towards the harbor and is divided by a raised garden bed that was originally a reflecting pool. Within the raised bed of the former reflecting pool is a tall concrete and bronze dedication plaque that reads William G. Irwin Memorial Park on both the front and back sides. Let's see. The diamond head of the walkway is the parking lot, which extends along Alamoana Boulevard to Bishop Street and encompasses the greatest area of land within the park, occupying a little over 1 acre. The parking area is the largest section of the park and also the most tree covered. The smallest section of the park is an approximate 0.25 acre strip of grassy tree covered lawn that constitutes what remains of the original green plaza. Adjacent to that green plaza and at the end of the walkway is a low circular fountain. Currently the fountain is inoperable and doesn't contain any water. The walkway reconnects on the opposite side of the fountain and continues towards Honolulu Harbor. The walkway's opening on the Mackay side of the fountain is cinched by a low curving wall that extends from the wall of the raised beds at the back. You can see where, and it wraps around the fountain, providing additional planting and seating. Irwin Park is significant at the state level under Criterion A. The park is of local significance under Criterion A as a component of the development of the piers 8, 9, 10, and 11, as well as for its role in the social history of car culture in Honolulu. The 1999 National Register nomination considered the property eligible under B and C, but is not in the submitted amended nomination. For criteria B, William Irwin was a significant person in the history of Hawaii, but the park is commemorative only and is not directly associated with his life or his career. Under criterion C, the park does not possess distinctive characteristics that make it eligible under this criteria. Although portions of the park were designed by very prominent Hawaii landscape architects, the Thompsons in the 30s and Richard Tong in the 60s, who would both be considered local masters, their designs were only partially implemented, and therefore the park is not an exemplary representation of their work. The period of significance for the park begins with its completion in 1934 and ends with the installation of the pedestrian walkway in 1965. There have been changes to the site as well as the surrounding buildings, but Irwin Park retains moderate integrity of location, setting, feeling, and association. Alterations to the footprint and the layout reduce the park's integrity of design, but not significantly. The two major changes to the park since 1934 are the loss of the acre from the building of Nimitz Highway and the addition of the pedestrian walkway in 1965, which has become historic in its own right. Both these alterations are considered historic, like I just said, and are intrinsic to Irwin Park and communicate the park's adaptability to the changing urban fabric of downtown Honolulu. Whew, that was a tough one. Sorry, guys. I really messed up my synopsis. I will stop sharing.
Thank you, Angie. Okay, first, is there any questions from the board for Angie?
So jump in. And it's probably not in the original the documentation, but on your slide, you say the significance is 1834, but I suspect that's just in your presentation, correct?
Oh, did I say 1834? No, it's 1934.
Yeah, that's printed 1834 on your slide. So anyway, because I was saying, whoa, really? Okay. All right, that makes sense. Did in your research in any way, did you ever function, and maybe Matt, I'm going to ask you if you know from your surveys, is Paka'a Heiau, was that there, right where Irwin Park is, or is it more Mauka of the site?
I think it would be more in the footprint of the other park we're going to look at.
Okay.
Yeah, that would be
the location. I know the fort was there. I never figured out exactly where Paka'a was relative to the fort. Was it Was it Mackay of the fort? Was it just to the left of the fort, looking north and south?
I think it would be kind of Mackay and a little bit Eva, the fort, but they...
Yeah, that's what I thought. But not probably under the highway then.
Right. It's right along the highway there. We've done a lot of excavation in that vicinity for utility monitoring. We've always been, you know, looking for that there. So far, nothing.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Bill. Any other questions from the board for Angie? Okay. I'd like it opened up to questions or comments from the audience. We don't particularly have a list that usually in person we have a sign-in list for people. I can call on people individually, but I think we could start with Michelle Mattson.
Thank you very much, Chair Stevens. I'm Michelle Mattson. I'm the president of the Oahu Island Parks Conservancy. And I'd just like to express our appreciation for your reviewing our testimony, the photographs we have sent in, the documentation as to the purpose, the legal purpose, and the continuing statutory purpose of a park, which now has plans for restoration with the harbors, the director of Harbors Division in full support, and we have taken this through past 30% now. Irwin Memorial Park is listed, already listed on the Register of Historic Places. And the State Historic Preservation Division historic site number is 80149829. This was not in this present application. It was overlooked. During its period of true significance, Irwin Memorial Park was the garden gateway to Honolulu for visitors arriving by passenger ship in Honolulu at Aloha Tower, greeted by tree-shaded landscape park and celebratory public gathering place. The contribution of Irwin Memorial Park to the larger historic waterfront district cannot be denied. In 1930, which is the beginning of the significant period for the park, Irwin Memorial Park was created as a landscape companion to Aloha Tower and the centerpiece park on the Honolulu waterfront, and introduced by public proclamation that a beautiful new park is assured. Upon completion, Irwin Memorial Park became the traditional gathering place on boat days for local residents and traveling visitors to congregate together with laymakers, friends, and family in the true Aloha spirit, and for other popular events at Irwin Memorial Park. Irwin Memorial Park is an early example of beautification that first began in the 1930s, meeting the following significance criteria. Two criteria of which the present application has completely dropped. Criterion A, for its association in the history of the first beautification efforts in downtown Honolulu as the waterfront's green open space. Criterion B, for its association with William G. Irwin, noted Hawaii shipping business founder, civic leader, philanthropist, and preservationist, as well as the original designers of the park, Thompson and Thompson. I have included in our testimony a complete description of how William G. Irwin functioned at on the piers and used the site of Irwin Park as a business place for his warehouses and coal storage area for the shipping business that in which he and Klaus Breckels were partners. Oceanic Steamship was right next to Irwin and Company. Criterion C for representing the work of prominent Honolulu landscape architects, Robert and Catherine Richards Thompson. The historic significance of the original landscape design of Irwin Memorial Park is carried through to today, by the presence of the original design's configuration of historic landscape design elements and features. The City's Heart sponsored alteration of this established listing seeks to substantially diminish the historic significance of Irwin Memorial Park by diluting the park's most significant period by eliminating 1930 to 1933 and incorporating diminished significance through 1965 and eliminating two important significance criteria from the 1999 registration. The Historic Sites Association with Significant Persons and its significant green landscape contribution to the larger historic district. Our testimony is respectfully offered in objection to the proposed application attempt to override the true and most significant history of Irwin Memorial Park. The stated purpose in the donor's reversionary deed and trust to the territory of Hawaii and the governor's executive order setting aside, that was in 1931, setting aside Irwin Memorial Park as a park and subsequently the perpetual protection of this park by state statute today. The waterfront land for Irwin Memorial Park was donated to the territory by a reversionary deed and trust on condition that this land was to be a public landscape memorial park, not a car park. Thus, it is difficult to comprehend or justify the proposed nomination's effort to replace criterion A in the established registration during Irwin Memorial Park's significant period with local, quote, local significance for its role in the social history of the car culture of Honolulu. The Section 106 programmatic agreement confirms that both historic Aloha Tower and its landscape companion Irwin Memorial Park will be adversely affected by the Heart Rail project in a manner that would diminish the integrity of the property, including foreseeable cumulative adverse effects that may concur later in time. As presently planned, the project is to bisect this historic downtown waterfront area with significant adverse visual and sound impacts. But instead of mitigating the project's adverse impacts on this historic site, the project seeks to self-mitigate by attempting to reduce and diffuse the significance of Irwin Memorial Park with this application, which concludes by focusing narrowly on car parking and parking lots. In conclusion, and with consideration of the above, we therefore strenuously object to the proposed nomination and respectfully request denial of same, which A, distorts and dilutes Irwin Memorial Park's true and original significant purpose and its 1930 to 1940 true period of significance, B, changes the statement of significance in major ways, and C, arbitrarily eliminates two established significant criterion. Should this application move forward, we hereby submit our request for a contested case hearing. Thank you for your time and consideration of this very important issue. Mahalo.
Thank you, Michelle. I'd like to see if there's any other people that wanted to ask a question or testify.
Yes, Chair, this is Winston Welch with the Outdoor Circle.
Okay, go ahead, sir.
Yes, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Winston Welch. I'm Executive Director at the Outdoor Circle, which has had a very long history and association with this park, including joining in the lawsuits that you have seen before you that have been referenced in the excellent testimony provided by Michelle Mattson and also Carol Fukunaga and John Whalen. I don't need to belabor the points that are before you. If you've read their testimony, you can see the important reasons why the Outdoor Circle would also be against classifying or re-registering Irwin Park based on the criteria before you. I think as a matter of public interest, of course, when an individual gives a piece of property to the state like this, it's incumbent with deed restrictions that it remain a park we really need to consider that that this sets a bad precedent. And I think the courts looked at that before and decided the same thing. But in practicality, when we run roughshod over this and dilute it in any way, whether it's a re-registration like this or wholesale transfer or whatnot, it affects the willingness of the public to, in fact, give, whether it's now or in 50 years from now. So we would ask that you take that into account, but also that, as Councilmember Fukunaga said, that really, rather than reducing Irwin Park's historic status as a park asset, we should honor the state's commitment to restore the park by relocating the park parking elsewhere, as is stated in the 1990 Aloha Tower EIS. Thereby, Hawaii residents, visitors, and local businesses can celebrate the restoration of Irwin Park that demonstrates respect for its historic architecture and sites unique to our history and heritage, and also as a gathering place as it was originally intended. Any aerial shot of this park shows that it is the only green space, and restoring it to what it was intended has been part of the state's plan on and off over the years. And I think we need to go back to that EIS, and we also need to look at the Supreme Court rulings in 2013, which upheld the land court decisions that denied the petition to expunge any restrictive covenants. So any attempt to reduce the importance of the persons associated with this or its place in Hawaii history, we would respectfully request that this be denied. And also that if the current petition before you is not denied, that the Outdoor Circle would respectfully submit a request for a contested case hearing. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I welcome any questions.
Thank you. Appreciate it. I think we'll just go forward with everybody that has comments, and then we'll come back to questions from the board for all of you all. So I see that John Whalen has his hand raised. Like to make a statement, sir?
Thank you. I won't repeat the testimony, written testimony that I submitted on behalf of Scenic Hawaii, which is took the lead in opposing the Attorney General's initiative to expunge the restrictive covenants that required park use attached to the donation of the land for the park. But I just want to point out the history of 12 years of litigation in that effort to protect the restrictive covenants for park use. And attached to that, it culminated in the Supreme Court decision, as previously mentioned. But a part of that important decision was the application of the private attorney general doctrine. It's the first time, it's a precedent setting decision for the first time that conferred the rights or acknowledged the rights of citizens to act as attorney general to protect the public interest when it's not being protected by the state. When the litigation started, it was in land court, and Judge Gary Chang pointed out that the State Historic Preservation Division was not even represented by an attorney, which was an important thing because it was listed on the register at that time. So he ordered the state to provide representation in the Attorney General's office. So that just shows that there wasn't a great deal of attention or interest in protecting the park, unfortunately, by the state. But in the 2013 Supreme Court decision, it upheld the land court's decision and established a private attorney general principle. That actually has ramifications. It's an event that is associated with Irwin Memorial Park. It was in a landmark case. there's no mention of it in the nomination. So if there's any alteration to the nomination, that should be the description that's added, because it is historic and has ramifications for other properties that that were gifts to the state or the public for the public trust, and where people have to intervene privately to protect those interests.
Okay, thank you, Sarah. You done?
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll move on to the next person. I see here Kamakana Kamuloa has her hand raised.
Thank you, Chair Stevens. My name is Kamakana Kamuloa. I'm actually the program manager at the Aloha Tower Development Corporation, the agency that has oversight, operational oversight over Orwin Park, through a lease from DOT Harbors, and we pass, and that is in turn leased by Hawaii Pacific University and Hawaii Life, their subsidiary, Hawaii Lifestyle Retail Properties. We just wanted to, we have no official position on the decision that sits before you. All I'd like to provide is some comments as to where we are with the quote unquote restoration or rehabilitation of the park. DOT Harbors actually several years ago committed some funds for the plan and design for returning Irwin Park, or increasing the green space at Irwin Park in with the goal of ultimately removing the parking from the park to enhance the ATDC or the Aloha Tower complex area. We've gone through initial phase of planning, and but it would require obviously consultation with State Historic Preservation Division on what that's going to look like when we finalize a plan. And it would also require additional funds to move forward with construction. So while we're just concerned at the impact that this may have on consultation in the future with possibly removing the hardscapes within the park to increase the green space, which would again enhance the beauty of the area and be more welcoming and return Aloha Tower to a people place. So that's all I have, just, and thank you for the opportunity to provide comments.
Thank you very much. Is there anybody else in the audience who would like to make a statement or ask a question? Okay, yes, Paul. You're on mute.
I didn't see any, preliminary designs for the restoration of the park. It would be interesting to see what you had in mind. And the other, I don't totally understand the ramifications of our approval or denial of this application as far as HART goes. I mean, in my mind, they're two separate issues, but I guess I don't totally understand the ramifications of our vote on this. If anybody could help me out, thank you.
I don't believe that Dr. Downer is back yet. I think he's still in his phone call with the Navy. Let's see, I think Chandra said that Susan Lebo is possibly with her, and I'm not sure if she can offer any insight to that. I mean, my sort of understanding of the process would be that if we did not accept this, or we do not vote to approve this amendment, then it would remain the previous nomination, that would still stand.
That's correct, Katie.
Yeah. Thank you,
Andrew. This has no ramifications whatsoever on anything that HART does, anything that White Harbors does, anything that the development company does. This is just an amendment of an existing nomination. So anything that they have planned,
Sorry, can the person that says Mary's iPhone, can you mute yourself, please? We got a lot of feedback.
Sorry.
Did you get your answer to your question?
Well, I just, so as far as pushing on with a redevelopment plan that would add more green space, if we approve this, will that negatively impact that redesign?
Effect whatsoever.
Yeah, the property would still be on the historic register and would still be under review of SHPD for their plan. Okay, I wanted to see if anybody from the board has any questions for any of the testifiers. Yeah, go ahead, Pat.
Thank you. As an historian, I see people that made a great impact on parts of history, sometimes lost, and names that remain familiar to us all. And I can appreciate the desire to have William Irwin listed, you know, and criterion B, but when I looked up the Park Service's how to apply National Register criteria for evaluation, it says really specifically that criterion B is generally restricted to those properties that illustrate rather than commemorate a person's important achievement. So it's speaking specifically to this commemorative park in that sense. And they give examples, the home of an important merchant or labor leader, the studio of a significant artist, the business headquarters of an important industrialist. But we don't have in this park space any building, any headquarters, any office where Mr. Irwin worked. And so I'm wondering how you see criterion B applying, not relative to his importance in building modern Hawaii, but to the Park Service's explanation of that criterion.
May I respond?
Yes, I was asking you, Ms. Metzen.
Oh, I didn't hear you call my name. Thank you. I think if you will review the current registration from 1999, you will see a paragraph on page 11 that explains exactly how William G. Irwin did use this site for his business, for his shipping agency, that was on Pier 10, adjacent to Oceanic Steamship. They had a coal yard. They had their own warehouses there. They were actively involved in this site, as well as Fort Street. And there is a description of what William G. Irwin implemented in this area for the shipping legacy that we still have today. So I would absolutely agree that William G. Irwin had a physical presence here at the site and in this area for a very long time. Thank you.
Thank you. And I did read it carefully, and that's what made me go back and look at what the Park Service is declaring as being appropriate for criterion B, because there is no physical office that he had there on the Memorial Park. And so it seems outside of it. I did want to mention, Angie, on the Walker Park in section 8, page 9, the criteria considerations, the letter F, a commemorative property is checked. It is not in Irwin Memorial Park. And that it seems like that would be an appropriate addition to check that box. And I also, on criterion C, it's my understanding, Angie, that from the beginning of this design, there was parking on half of it, that there was always parking within the park. So if it were criterion C, from the changes that are being proposed with Mr. Cunnelaw and others, would that restrict the ability to do something that was never there in the beginning?
That would be Shifty's call. But you're absolutely right. There was parking on the property from the very beginning. Ms. Mattson had suggested that 1930 was the beginning of the period of significance. But the park was actually dedicated as Irwin Memorial Park in 1934, which is why we use that date. Prior to that, they were still doing demolition on the site and, you know, whatever excavation plan, you know, and creating it. We use the same criteria for our date that we use for buildings. We don't say a building is significant for the day that it breaks ground. It's for the day that it's completed. So that's why it's 1934 for this site. I just wanted to clarify that.
Oh, yes, we understand the direction you've taken. However, the commitments and the protection of this site were made in 1930 and 1931. That's when the absolute protection began. The parking was it was not half the park. It was about a third of the park along Halicavilla Street, where Nimitz Highway came in and took out the parking. So you had a beautiful celebratory gathering place for boat days and other events on two-thirds of that site. And that's where the historic portion is. We do not agree that the later period of lesser significance is something that will benefit the restoration. In fact, it was a concrete hardscape that bisected the park, took up a fifth of it, and it was a pedestrian walkway with concrete and concrete hardscape around it. This is not consistent with the landscape importance of this park and its dedicated area or its purpose. And this needs to be restored. If you go strictly by the original boundaries, the parking was removed. And Thompson and Thompson's elements are still reflected in the configuration of this area. So there are very significant portions remaining, and they need to be honored and restored. Thank you.
May I ask this question? Do you have the Thompson and Thompson plans? Because for this nomination, both in 1999, whoever did that, and for this one, those were not located.
I believe the historic landscape architect who has done the restoration plan found that original design, and we have submitted it as a photograph in our testimony.
Well, that would be something that we would love to include in the nomination. It's not something that any of the researchers that have worked on this project for a number of years had ever located prior to this. So that would be great if we could get a copy of that to add to the nomination.
I really appreciate it. And I think it's very important that that be done. The design was with the full agreement of the donor. And these were very important architects. These were master landscape architects of the era. Of course, you may, of course, know that they designed Thomas Square, Alawana Park, and Washington Place landscaping. So there is a lot of significance peripherally and directly with this current registration, and to have it compromised and undermined is highly objectionable. The significance is with the significant era, not with pieces that have been put in or taken out, such as the utility cabinets in the center of the park. They're still there. They are certainly not going to be part of the restoration, nor the bollards and the Manila palms have nothing to do with the historic landscape. Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle. Angie, did you have any further questions?
Katie?
Yeah. Yes, Don.
I'd like to talk more to Paul's question about the ramifications.
Sure.
Of the nomination. Just from what I've been hearing, I haven't looked at the new nomination at all. I do recall the old one when it was put on. I think it goes beyond just what SHPD will determine. The registration document is a legal document. And if I think what Michelle and the other people are concerned about is if this goes to court, the only thing the court will look at as to why this property is significant is what is in the new nomination if it's approved. So I think that's the ramification that I think other people are concerned about.
Thank you, Don.
Right, but we can't base a nomination on a plan that was not realized. We also can't ignore a change to the site that was made in the 1960s by another master landscape architect. So we have to base the nomination on what was actually done and what is actually there. It can't be based on what Mrs. Fagan wanted to be there, what the Thompsons wanted to be there. It has to be based on actual history and what is there now. And I think that's, and I understand totally your, Mrs. Mattson, your frustration with this, but that's the way we have to look at this to do a nomination. And I think Don is right. It could go to court if SHPD's whatever SHPD determines isn't what other people might like. But the nomination itself, we have to follow the NPS rules. We have to do research on what was actually done on the site, and we can talk about, and we did, plans that were put forward, which is why I'd love to have the Thompson and Thompson plans, but we can only write the nomination and its integrity on what was actually put there and what is actually there now. And I do feel that that's what we have done. And we don't mean to lessen Irwin's importance in history, not at all. And what Pat said about the very strict criteria for or criteria B is what we followed. And we did a lot of research about where he did business and how the business was done. The site was purchased by his daughter in 1930. It wasn't like it was even in the family at that point. So that's just based on our research, the way we had to go with this.
Thank you, Angie. Go ahead, Pat.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, with, again, criterion C, The same directive, Bulletin 15, says in the not eligible category, a designed landscape that has had major changes to its historic design, vegetation, original boundary, architectural features, and circulation system. And I read a fair amount in here about having almost an acre lopped off at the top. And I am a fan of Richard Tong. He cited our house when we had to cut it in three pieces and move it some years ago. And I think his work is also really important to the site, even though it's not a huge percentage. It did change the architectural features. And, you know, when I'm looking at this, at these things and these questions, it's not... I think that Honolulu should be very grateful for the establishment of this park and the maintenance of it, and to put Mr. Irwin's name out there to remember that this was a man that did a lot. I also am an urban forester and in a program that's working to catalog all of the trees in our public spaces. So I appreciate parks as well, but when I look at the criteria for both B and C, it did make sense to me why, without diminishing the importance of the site and thoughts of restoring, rehabilitating, reconstructing, it sounds like there are plans for a little bit of all three. That's wonderful. And I wish that in the nominations, because it's clear that some of you have been really involved with this for a long time. And I think community advocacy is something that I'd really like to see more of in the written nomination. You know, my hat's off to you on this as well. But having read that not eligible with a category on designed landscapes, sounded like it was written for the Irwin Memorial Park.
Thank you, Pat. Mr. Whalen, you had additional comment?
I think he just left his hand up, but I have a hand up too.
No, he was raising his actual hand.
Okay, sorry. just very short. In comment on the impact of changing this registration, going back to the litigation I referred to earlier, it's important to acknowledge whether those improvements or changes to the park subsequent to 1940 were consented to by the owners or the donors of the land that have those restrictive covenants attached. And that one of the requirements is that consent be explicitly given. And they did not actually consent to most of those improvements. When Nimitz Highway was expanded, the state promised to create a land exchange with the owners to replace the park, because the donors were pretty upset about all the changes that have been occurring to the park, and most of those were done without their consent. The state proceeded anyway. When the highway was widened, the parking was expanded on the Mackay side, because they didn't want to lose the number of spaces that were that they had previously. And the owners, the donors did not approve of that, but the state did it anyway. And so the significance of the Supreme Court's upholding those restrictive covenants should be acknowledged. And just because something exists doesn't mean that it exists legally. It just means that the state exercised its power to proceed regardless of the landowner's consent, the original landowner's consent.
Thank you, sir. Bill Chapman.
First of all, I want to compliment all the people who have come to testify. I think it shows a real civic commitment, and it's something that, of course, we on the board support. I also think, you know, that Angie and her firm has not been sinister about this and is really trying to simply bring the nomination more into keeping with modern day practice. And, you know, back in 1980, when this was nominated before, it seems that B was kind of used more loosely than it is now. And a lot of the guidance was published subsequent to that in the late 80s and 90s, where they really suggested that if there is a association that isn't direct, it doesn't actually constitute something that person would have recognized and been part of or lived in, that it would be covered under criterion A. And I think she's done that accurately. I think what Pat brought up was interesting about how a design landscape is assessed. On the other hand, I guess my question begins with how much of the Thompson and Thompson landscape was realized. It's hard to say when you have large trees that it's not going to be realized immediately. And I don't know how much of the planting had been done prior to 1940, but my suspicion is a lot of it. And that, and one thing I learned in the course of my now seemingly long career is that it is possible to exercise judgment on significance. All things are not equally significant. And I'm going to just do a little sidetrack here. I was once nominating a plantation estate in the West Indies and had a lot of going back and forth with the Park Service because I did exactly what Angie did. I talked about each change over time, including the time when the main plantation house lost its roof, the time in the 1960s when a modernist architect put on a really inappropriate roof. And I didn't try to assess what's more important than what's less important. I simply bundled it all together and it was sent back several times. In the meantime, a wealthy guy from New York, Richard Jenrette, bought the house and wanted to restore it to its 18th century appearance, which is certainly something allowed for in the Park Service. So ultimately, I ended up revising the nomination to suggest that the period of significance was between 1770 and 1840, when there are things there, and that things that postdated that period do not bear the same level of significance. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been able to do anything with the park. So I do think this is a kind of comparable case where you've got to say, what is the most important part of this? Because the Thompson and Thompson Park, seems to be the period of greatest significance. And as much as Richard Tong is respected, his was a minor change to the park. And I don't think they should have their hands tied if they want to restore the park to its pre-1940s configuration either. So those are my comments. And I guess my inclination as a board member would be to simply leave this, I don't know what the motion will be, Katie, but to not proceed with the revision of the nomination because so much is going on in terms of the future of this park right now. So that's my piece. Let me take down my hand.
Okay. Thank you, Bill. Michelle Masson, you still have your hand up there. I don't know if it's just you wanted to say something else or is that still left up?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I forgot about that.
Just wanted to make sure. Okay. Is there any other comments or questions? Okay. And this has been stated now to be a contested case, I'd like to have Dr. Downer just sort of explain the procedure for that. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Katie. This is fairly complicated. So if somebody needs me to explain something or go over something again, please feel free to ask. So the Attorney General's position is that if before the board takes a vote, a contested case is requested, the Attorney General recommends against voting. So in this case, the recommendation from the AG would be not to take a vote. The people requesting the contested case must make a written request within 10 days of the close of this meeting. If they do send in that written request. We would consult with the Attorney General, and the Attorney General, based on that, we would recommend to the board that it either accept the, you know, grant the contested case or deny the contested case, depending on the, you know, the advice of the Attorney General. This would then mean that by the, you know, this would be a business item on the next board meeting where the board would take up and decide, yes, we're going to, you know, we're going to take the action recommended by the AG or not. If the recommendation, if there's a contested case, the board, the AG recommends that they, you know, that you approve that you grant it, then we would have to go through the process. And I would actually have to go back and look at the rules and consult with the AG on this. It may be the case that we would have to get the Attorney General to appoint a hearing officer, or it may be that this contested case is held before the board. I don't know that. I would suspect probably a hearing officer. And then there would be a formal hearing on, if the contested case is granted, there'd be a formal hearing under before an administrative law judge. You know, witnesses would be sworn in, testimony would be taken, and you know, at the end of the process, the hearing officer would make a recommendation to the board. So, anybody have any questions on that?
Yeah, not one, Alan. The question might be is, could the nomination, given what I just suggested, be, this is ultimately, it's a matter of arguing like any legal case, what's the most significant parts of the site. Pat made a good case that there's a linear kind of continuous significance in different ways, but I think one could argue that the true significance is the part before 1940 and the Thompson design. I don't think we'd want to reverse the issue on whether it's commemorative or not and use criterion B, but I think you could make a strong case for redrafting the nomination to emphasize that period as the period of significance.
I'm not sure what the question is, Bill.
Not a question. I guess the question would, but it was a comment more than a question. I guess the question would be, can we send Angie back and suggest that perhaps she revisit the relative significance?
If the board were to say, we're going to defer this pending the decision on the contested case, the board could recommend that, you know, an action like that. I think that I don't think. I don't think that would. I'm going to say that that would not affect the contested case in any way. But bearing in mind that not all actions are contestable, and not everybody who asks for a contested case actually has a right to one, and that's why we have to consult with the Attorney General.
Is there any impact on us stating that this would be deferred? I mean, does that actually make any difference?
The recommendation from the AG would be that the board defer action on it.
What do we do today, Alan?
What's that? You mean
what do we defer? What do we do today? What's our motion today?
Well, the motion, I think, would be to defer.
Defer, yeah.
Okay, thank you. Anybody have any further questions for Dr. Downer?
Just regarding the contested case, if we defer it, does the contested case go forward? There hasn't been a decision. What are they contesting?
Well, I mean, the first thing that has to happen is that they have to request that contested case in writing. If they get that, we would consult with the Attorney General, and they would make a recommendation either to grant the contested case or deny it. And then, you know, that decision is made by the board itself. So we would come back to the board presumably at the next meeting and say, here's the Attorney General's recommendation either to approve or deny the contested case. So, you know, I mean, we are, as if I am understanding your question right, Matt, we're a long way from knowing whether there would in fact be a contested case.
So at this point, we would just defer it pending review of the contested case application.
Right, assuming that a written request is made, yes.
Okay.
May I clarify something?
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you. My statement at the end of my testimony was, should this application move forward, we submit our request for a contested case hearing. If it is deferred to an unknown time with revisions, the question, you know, that is not moving it forward. So we would not request a contested case hearing. But revisions would need to be made to propose to the review board if there are to be any revisions as possible amendments to the existing registration. The existing registration needs to stand, or there will be a contested case hearing. So those are just some points to further the conversation. Thank you.
If I could just clarify the what you just said. So it's the existing nomination or a contested case. If there's some sort of a meeting between you folks and the people who wrote the current revised nomination, you come to some common ground, that's not acceptable. You don't want to have a revised nomination at all.
No,
you
no.
Just want to have the current one.
I didn't say that. I said that any amendments would have to be amendments to the existing nomination, not a replacement. That was the big question we had coming into this, is what is this all about? Here comes Hart trying to erase history, the shipping history, to replace it with rail. And why are they reducing the meaning of this important location that does still have its original shape and location and setting? So we had the question of what is this all about? Is it a replacement? Is it an amendment that will be tacked on the end? How will it be structured? Nobody seems to know.
But are you amenable to a revised or amended nomination form, an update of what was done in 1990?
We would have to review anything that is otherwise proposed to see if the proposal is compatible with the existing registration. We do understand that there are items of less significance that are 50 years old. Could they be incorporated into the restoration, or would they absolutely, not be compatible? So this discussion needs to be had. It has never been taken place, and Hart has forged ahead with their own requirements to mitigate for their own purposes, but they're not mitigating their impacts. They are mitigating the historic sites in significance, so their impacts appear less. And that's their interpretation of mitigation. Thank you.
Can I say that Hart had no input whatsoever in our research or our writing of this, other than to review it? We had no agenda, and I don't know. I'm just going to assume Hart had no agenda other than fulfilling the PA. They did not have any kind of input into what we wrote, other than to review it.
I do have a question about that, because this was under their own mitigation requirement, and it's difficult to understand how they could not have had, made a request to do certain things, or Irwin Memorial Park has this history And to undermine that history or to diminish that history assists Hart in proving that they don't have as much to mitigate. So I don't understand where this is coming from. I can't imagine that this proposal did not go through an approval process after Mason's firm wrote the original. We understand that it is, this sort of thing is reviewed by the stakeholders. And yet our review was upon the notice of this agenda. And we have been stakeholders for a very long time.
They reviewed the nomination, yes, but they had no input into its content, is all I was saying. We as professionals who do this on a daily basis wrote this based on our best ability, experience, and research, but Hart did not direct us in any direction regarding this nomination.
Okay, so at this point, Dr. Downer, maybe you can discuss this a little bit. We could either defer this if the person who submitted this application, which would be Angie or Mason Architects, would agree that they would consider looking at additional information provided by others to potentially modify their submittal, but possibly they don't want to do that. They may say we would like to leave this as stands, in which case do we then need to vote on it? Because this is not going to be a contested case unless this current nomination is approved.
Let me say one more thing. As I said previously, I would love to see those plans that we were not able to locate. And if that, and seeing those plans would add to the narrative, there's no doubt. And if it changes somehow, we would make those changes. But yeah, so we'd be happy to see whatever you have that we haven't had access to this point.
Okay. So I think, this is, and procedurally, this is actually kind of a twisted knot. If the contested case is only going to be triggered by the board action, then, I don't know how you handle that, because if the normal process is to say, if somebody gives you that they're, during their testimony says, we want a contested case, then, that should, based on the attorney general's advice, that should trigger a board action to defer. In this case, what it sounds like is if the board defers, more work is done, it comes back, and then the board wants to take action, but the same assertion is made, we will contest if you vote yes. This sounds like will lead to sort of this indefinite delay in the board action. If the board wants to take action now and that triggers the contested case, understanding that if the contested case is granted and the hearing officer recommends it, the board may have to undo its prior action. So I don't know, that sounds even more complicated now that I've said it out loud than it did when I was trying to think my way through it. If that wasn't clear, let me, ask me questions. I'll try to clarify.
Could we possibly ask if Angie would like to request that it be deferred?
Yes, I would. And Hart would too. We'd like to defer it till March. And in that period, we need to get, if possible, Ms. Mattson, the information that you have, the plans that you have from Thompson and Thompson. And we will make changes as the history shows. Is that possible?
Well, certainly we would agree to meet to discuss the elements of these plans and to provide a copy. It's public information. I believe SHPD has it now, but if you are interested in modifying what you have put forth, it bears further discussion as to how that would be modified. And then we would make our decision based on the progress of that discussion.
Yeah, it sounds like what would happen if it's deferred and then Angie and Mason Architects can receive the additional information, perhaps have discussions with you. They would probably put forth a new nomination, in which case the board would need to make a decision then whether they would like to proceed with that nomination or not. And then at that time, you can again decide whether you would like to contest it. Does that sound correct, Dr. Downer?
Thank you. We appreciate that.
Yes, that seems like that seems proper and appropriate.
Okay. Now that Hart and the nominator is requesting deferral, do we actually need to vote for it to be deferred, or can it just simply be deferred by their request?
Once you approve the agenda in order to remove an item, you will take action by the board to defer.
Okay, thank you. Okay, would anybody like to make a motion to defer? Or make a motion?
Be happy to help, but I'm not quite sure what the motion will say. But basically, I want to allow for the deferment of this nomination and to revise our agenda to reflect that. I guess that we need to say that.
Thank you, Bill. Any second? Okay, Paul seconds. Okay, any other comments or questions? Okay, let's take a vote to defer this nomination for Irwin Memorial Park. Okay, looks like unanimous yes. Thank you. All right. Thank you, Angie. Thank you, everybody that provided testimony today. Let's see.
Could I just ask a quick question?
Yes, since we have Alan here?
I mean, this may be informative for Michelle and other people too. I mean, the nomination itself is to establish what the significance of that property is. She's been talking a little bit about issues of mitigation and impacts and stuff like that. And this is actually directed at Alan. So what has the SHPD decided in terms, or do you even have an opportunity to decide in terms of the impacts upon a historic site of the rail itself? Visual impacts and things like that. Is that something you've already covered?
That's actually covered by the programmatic agreement, Bill. So that was all settled before I got here. And whether or not either doing or updating a nomination is an appropriate mitigation measure is, I guess anybody's free to feel about that.
Yeah, I remember when I served on the board in Georgia, we would look at individual impacts on National Register properties and saw that things had to be relocated because of the visual impacts. So.
So, I mean, with respect to the rail, the programmatic agreement itself was designed to, take into account the effects of the rail project and, where those effects weren't known to, establish the process by which they'll be addressed. At this point, I don't have the PA in front of me, so I can't look it up and say, there's another thing that has to be factored into assessing the effects at this location on this National Register property beyond doing, updating the nomination. I would, if you want me to try to answer that question, I could be prepared to answer it.
I think you've answered to my point. I understand. I kind of suspected that was covered in the programmatic agreement, but I could see why people wouldn't feel that may not be satisfactory.
All Okay, thank you. Mr. Tam, is he still here? Yeah, did you have a question or comment?
I could just add into that. So, you know, the mitigation that we have for the rail project, you know, it includes updating this National Register nomination. We also prepared a cultural landscape report for Irwin Park, which could influence potential improvements there. But that's, again, up to stakeholders and the our historic preservation committee. So again, the rail is not touching Irwin Park. It's just in the median of Nimitz Highway. And so the mitigation is for kind of the visual, the impacts to setting of the park. So.
Thank you.
That's all. Thanks.
Thank you. Okay. Any other questions or comments related to Irwin Park nomination? Okay, thank you, everybody. So it's almost 12 o'clock, so I just wanted to see if there was any preference to continue on with our next nomination or have a lunch break at this time. So, board members.
If I could have a preference, I actually have to go, and I have one more to do, and it's pretty short, if you guys wouldn't mind.
Is it, there is only one more, right, Katie?
Oh. I think... no, there's also the surf and sea, which Don Hibbert is waiting to present. But yeah, so we could move forward with Walker Park. Or does anybody, would anybody like to have a 5-minute break? Okay, we can just move forward with Walker Park. Go ahead, Angie.
Yeah, sorry to steal your break, but this one's pretty quick. Let me share my screen. This also is a HART-initiated nomination as mitigation for the project. Walker Park is a triangular landscaped park and plaza at the southern terminus of Fort Street Mall. First created in 1952 with the construction of Nimitz Highway, it was redesigned as a commemorative park in 1972. This one also was partially designed by Catherine and Robert Thompson, as well as Anthony Gazzaro and Associates out of San Francisco. And then the plaza itself was done by architect William Podesto. It is located in the southwest corner of downtown Honolulu, across Nimitz Highway from Piers 10 and 11 at Honolulu Harbor, and across the street from Irwin Park. It's bounded by Queen Street, Nimitz Highway, and the Topa Financial Center. The park will be adjacent to the new rail line that will run from along Nimitz Highway and Alamoana Boulevard. A rail station will be located a block from the park at Pacific Guardian Center and the Dillingham Transportation Building. The oval marks the location of the park, and then you can see where the station is. Prior to the construction of Nimitz and Alamoana at the harbor end of downtown, the area of present-day Walker Park consisted of a grassy strip median with palm trees and a paved triangular median that was home to a cannon. This view is Eva, likely from the Hackfield Building. And you can see the cannon right here on its own little triangle right there. When these two areas were consolidated and enlarged by the Nimitz Highway Project in 1952, Fort Street was still a particular road. And the park was mostly just a grassy median with mature palm trees that were saved during the construction. Plus the addition of the new trees, including three newly planted banyan trees. And at this time, the park did not have a name.
The cannon, believed to be from the original
fort, remained as the only other feature of the pocket park.
This is a
1953 elevated Malka view up from Fort Street. For nearly two decades, the park remained unchanged. In 1969, Fort Street was converted into a pedestrian mall from Baratania Street to Queen Street. The section of Fort Street from Queen to Nimitz remained a vehicular thoroughfare. In 1968, the old courthouse was demolished to make way for the Amfac Center Towers. And in 1970, the H. Hackfield Building was demolished for the second of the two towers. In 1971, the last block of Fort Street between Queen and Nimitz was converted into a plaza that served several roles. It created an impressive entry space for the new tower, formed a better pedestrian connection to the Traffic Island Park, and extended the path of Fort Street Pedestrian Mall. It may also have been the first example of in Honolulu of a nationwide trend of open spaces developed by private entities. I just wanted to interject a note about the number of resources. The count of contributing and non-contributing
contributing resources found in the
National Register Bulletin 16A, How to Complete National Register Nomination Forms, is a little murky, but we followed their guidelines as best as we could to interpret them, and we used the CLR that was also produced for this park as our guidance for what is contributing and what is not contributing for this resource. Salvage objects and building materials, including the old H. Hackfield and Company gate, a basalt sculpture created with H. Hackfield and Company building stones, and coral blocks from the old courthouse basement were added to the site in keeping with AMTAC president's promise to develop a historic display. This is the H. Hackfield and Company gate that once stood between Hackfield Building and the old courthouse. We saw that actually in the previous pictures. This is coral blocks salvaged from the basement of the old courthouse. Here we have basalt blocks from the Hackfield Building stacked to form an abstract sculpture. The cannon, with its 1930s replica of a traditional wood cannon carriage.
This is one of the dedication plaques, of which there are many. This is a view
diamond head of the park towards the Topa Towers. 22. And this is a view along the plaza. Here we have the fountain by San Francisco architect William Podesto and San Francisco landscape architecture firm Anthony Guazzaro and Associates. The sculpture in the middle is by Sean K.L. Brown, entitled Puna, and was added in 1991 in memory of Una Walker, the mother of the other guys here, and wife of Alexander Sr., to whom the overall park is dedicated. A memorial plaque for their son, Henry, the president of ANFAC at the time of the plaza's creation and who oversaw its design and commemorative details, was added in 2000. Walker Park is significant at the state level under criteria A and C. Under A, it is significant with post-war II community planning and transportation on the island of Oahu. It is a result of the booming growth in Honolulu after the war, its burgeoning car population, and highway beautification efforts of the time. The park is significant under C as a modern pedestrian plaza, possibly the first such corporate pocket park in Hawaii. It also meets criterion F for commemorative properties, such that it was designed after the life of an important person, in this case, Alexander Walker, as evidence of a later generation's assessment of the past. The park may also be eligible under D for its architectural value from the period of the fort, but additional research would need to be undertaken to determine this. And that is it. If you're what's going on here? This is from the nomination itself, and this is a list of all of the contributing and non-contributing resources.
Okay, that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Andy. Can you unshare?
So, Katie, if I could ask, Andy, are you saying that It does meet, because of criteria exception F, it can be nominated under criterion B as well?
No, it's not being nominated under B. No, it's purely commemorative. And I think, I can't remember who said it, you or Pat or somebody, that is something that I will further investigate once I get the additional materials for Irwin, to see if we can make that same claim for Irwin, which it seems like we can.
Angie, can you unchair, please?
Can I? Oh, yes, sorry.
Thank you.
Such a pretty fountain.
It's true. a question, one of the questions I had was your period of significance is 1952 to 1972, but 1972 is not yet 50 years old. So I didn't know if that really, we could use that as a period of significance, although.
Well, I think we can, because it will be 50 by the time this gets forwarded to the National Register, and they don't really care about that anyway. So by the time all the paperwork is done and all of that, it should be 50. And I did think about that. But since we're already towards the middle end of November, I think by the time this all gets sorted out, it will be 50.
For the State Register, if we move this forward and voted to put this onto the State Register, that would happen immediately. And the State Register requires it to be 50 years old. So my thought in regards to that, I mean, we have other questions and things to discuss, is you could possibly consider deferring this to the next meeting, because that time it would be 50 years old.
If that's what you want to do, that's fine.
That would be one way to deal with at least that question.
Yeah.
Because I understand some of what you're contributing to the significance of this happened in 1972. So you don't want to back the period of significance.
Right. No, we don't.
Yeah. Okay. But okay. So any other questions for Angie from the board?
I just have a real minor one on that significance. The name that is being honored, you say Alexander Walker, but isn't it Henry Alexander Walker? I think that's his middle name. It's just a minor detail.
I would have to look. I don't recall right now, but I can look that up.
Henry A. was the first.
There was a plaque. Did it say Henry A?
I think so.
Okay. Sure. Well, I can make that change.
Yeah,
just, then.
It's
that's
a
no
minor
problem.
Thing.
Yeah, but we want it to be correct.
Happen to know the family.
Henry and not Alex. Okay, even though he went by his middle name. Gotcha.
And Julia asked that one of us correct the verbal record. When you mentioned criterion D, you mentioned architecture. When you meant to say archaeology, I think.
I did. Sorry. It's my default.
Sorry, Matt.
Okay, thank you, Paul and Bill. Any further questions for Angie? Anybody in the audience have any questions for Angie? Okay.
I have a quick question, Katie.
Sure.
The sculpture is 1999. That wasn't part of the fountain design, or it was part of the fountain design, or?
That was a later addition by a local artist.
To the fountain.
To the fountain, yes. Uh-huh. So it's a non-contributing because it's pretty new.
Weird.
It feels like it's always been there.
Any other questions? Okay, I just want to confirm with Dr. Downer that that's correct, that this we would need to wait until next year if we wanted to include the period of significance being to 1972.
The State Register, that's correct.
Okay, so I'm wondering if Angie, if you would want to request to defer this to the next meeting. Otherwise, what we would be doing is not voting to put this on the State Register. And we would, if you would like, we could forward that to the National Register, but we couldn't look at things in 1972 as putting it under the State Register.
Ryan just had a thumbs up from Hart, yes. So I think he is pro deferring. Is that right, Ryan?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, yeah, we'll just defer it along with the other park and we'll deal with them next time.
Okay, thank you, Angie. So
I was just taking into account that it usually takes at least a couple months for us to get the letter saying that's been put on the register. Yes. So I thought we'd be okay.
But technically it gets put on immediately, so.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So what we need then is a motion from the board, somebody on the board to defer this.
I move to defer this nomination until next March.
Thank you, Pat. Any second?
Seconded.
Okay, this is Matt seconded. Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Okay, all in favor of deferring this to the next meeting? Okay, there we go. All six. Okay, thank you. Question. Thanks, Angie.
For the March meeting, will I represent it or is it just something that will come up for a vote?
I think that would be up to you whether you would like to do another presentation. It probably wouldn't be necessary. Maybe you'd want to just do just a quick reminder for us or so.
Okay. Well, this one's pretty quick anyway. So, yeah. Okay. Yeah. I just wondered what you wanted. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. I think this might be a good time to take a quick lunch break and then we can finish up with the Surf and Sea and any of the other meeting information, unless somebody would like to suggest that we skip lunch.
Okay. I don't mind skipping lunch if we get a 5-minute break, personally.
Okay.
But I'll do lunch.
Other Whatever. Board members?
I'm good with working through straight through too. Just get it done.
Okay. Matt's a yes. Pat's a yes.
Bill? I say yes. I can eat my lunch in 5 minutes.
Okay. We'll take another 5-minute break and then come back and resume the meeting. So it is right now 12:10, correct? Okay. We'll come back at 12:15. Thank you. Okay, Pat, Alton, and Bill, just let us know when you're back, please. Pat Griffin, are you back yet? There you are. Thanks. Okay, looks like the board's all here, and so we can continue on with our next nomination, Surf and Sea Billing. Don Hibbard.
Okay, I can put on share screen.
Sorry, one more time. Right.
Okay. This is the Surf and Sea Building in Haleiwa. It's along the main road, just past the Anahulu Stream Bridge with the double arches. It sits by itself on the right-hand side of the road. Here you can see an overview. Here's the bridge. And then going in here, it sits on this parcel of land here. The building is owned by the state of Hawaii, the boating program. They acquired the property in 1965 when Haleiwa Harbor was improved. And before that, it was owned by Liliuokalani Trust. And unfortunately, I checked with the trust and they don't have their real estate records for this property any longer. It's part of a much larger property, which also includes part of the beach park. So we're just doing a portion of the property on which the building stands. The building is already listed. The city and county has the Haleiwa Historic Cultural and Scenic District. It's listed in that as a significant building. And we're nominating it today to the Hawaii Register of Historic Places at the local level under Criterion C, as a good example of a two-story wood commercial building constructed in Hawaii during the opening decades of the 20th century. It's typical of its period and its use of materials, method of construction, craftsmanship, and design. Just to let you know, my history with the building goes back to the 1990s. At that time, the person who runs Surf and Sea, Joe Green, came in and told me that the state wants to tear down the building. And as a result, we started corresponding with the Harbors Division and indicating that we thought it was a historic site and that we would not approve the demolition of the building. Joe at that time was on a revocable permit, which is essentially a month-to-month lease on the building. He'd had that since 1982. And at the time that finally this land management took over the property from boating, and they wanted to, they said, yes, we'll preserve the building. And what they were planning to do was enter into a long-term lease with Joe Green. Different staff changed hands and the long-term lease was never done. Now it's coming up again, and they want a long-term lease on the property, and which the state seems to be willing to offer, but they want the property registered. So that's why we're coming now to register the property. The property is a two-story building, which I'm not sure exactly when it was built because we haven't been able to get the records from Lilio Kalani Trust, and being in Haleiwa, the city directories don't have addresses. They'll just list things as Haleiwa. And so I'm still trying to find out exactly when, but some say it was built when the bridge was built in 21. I'm suspecting it might be a couple of years older, but in the nomination, I just say circa 1921. The two wings on either end, the single story wings, were added later. They were here already in 1982 when Joe got the property, but we're not sure before how much sooner before. The building was turned into the Surf and Sea originally in 1964. So he thinks sometime probably between 64 and 82 when he got it, that these two wings were added. I think the building is strong enough that the two wings do not diminish the integrity of the property. You can see most of the property is intact. Here's what was the original storefront. This storefront's been modified. I suspect the two picture windows have been modified too, although I suspect there were display windows here. The second floor remains intact with its double hung sash windows. Then you have some circular vents up above. There's a shed roof that runs towards the back. Here you can get a view of the original double doors. And here you can see the awning has been replaced, but it was replaced in more or less in kind, retaining the same design. The windows are all intact on the second floor. And the ventilators up above. And then you have a small modest cornice with medallions, which is typical of commercial buildings of the time. And vertical T&G walls. On the inside, the interior has been totally modified, has new ape floors. Essentially, you can see new ceilings. Here's new beams that have been put in. Even though he's on a month-to-month, he's invested a lot of money into the property to make sure that the building remains stable. And here's just another view. You can see it's pretty much a clutter. And then there's a bathroom, which is all totally modern on the first floor, restroom. And then there's stairs that lead up to the second floor. The second floor back in the day was residential. Now it's used for storage as well. If you ever wonder what's behind one of those circular vents, this is what it looks like from the inside. On the second floor, there is a kitchen that's used as a break room by the staff. But essentially it's mainly just storage. Here's sliding windows which lead out to a lanai, a deck. Here you can see the deck from the outside. These are here's smaller sliding windows, and here's very large sliding windows, which you obtain somewhere. Here's a closer view of those. And then the deck essentially runs across the rear of the building and looks out onto Haleiwa Harbor. Another view. And a view from down at the ocean level. Here's a view from the ocean looking back towards the building. This is what the rear. It's not historic at all. It's totally been changed, but it's also not visible from the street. Here you can see the side. Here's the addition. And then they have a nice Bob Marley mural on this side, which was done Powwow, who's done a lot of graphics in Kaka'ako, did this, and it's done by an artist named Cryptic. And essentially, here's the beach in front, and then it runs over, and here's the beach park. So that's the building. I think it's important. It's a very major landmark in Haleiwa. It's one of the larger buildings in polyeven, very conspicuous, and is essentially a small landmark within the community. And as the major surfboard shop, of course, is associated with surfing in the North Shore as well. I did a little inventory. There's hardly any two-story wood frame commercial buildings left on Oahu. And I think this is probably one of the best examples of it. There's another one in Haleiwa, which is this building, which I know nothing about, other than that it's also listed as a significant property. This is just as you're entering Haleiwa on the left. In Wahiawa, I found these two buildings on Kane Road. This is a concrete building in the middle. As you can see, this one, the balcony's all been enclosed with T111. This one too has had several modifications, although it's still recognizable. Also in Wahiawa is this building, which has been all new windows, both floors. I'm not even sure if they reworked this roof. In Kailua, there's this building still standing, which is sort of a different style with a hip roof. And at the corner of Lusitana, Miller, and Captain Cook, there's this building, which used to be a pink colored building. It was all TNG. They've stuccoed the whole building and changed all the windows on this as well. Also in Honolulu, this is a rather better one. This is on King Street, right past Liliha Street. Here's the Shea Lane. And this is the old Fuji'i store, which dates from 1905. But again, you can see all the windows have been altered. The rear also has all been altered. And obviously this has all been enclosed as well. On Palama Street, there's this store. Again, this has all been redone with T111 and new windows upstairs. This one further down on King Street, this is at Peterson Lane. And again, all T111, which seems to be a common way of reinforcing the buildings. This one is further down. This one is on Walters Lane. And again, this one is fairly intact, but obviously has had a number of alterations. And then at the Y Camilo and King Street is this two-story structure, which has all plywood on the outside and is some kind of aluminum or vinyl siding all put in here with new windows. So that's the extent of two-story commercial buildings that I've been able to find on Oahu. And so I think the Surf and Sea stands as a really good example. It's in the Haleiwa Designs District. And so I think it has a good chance of remaining. And I think especially if Joe gets a long-term lease on the building, its chances of preservation are very high. That's my report. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer.
Thank you, Don. Okay, any questions or comments from the board?
Don, why did you exclude the one on Queen Street? That yellow green one on Queen Street, did that not meet the criteria for the, doesn't have a shed roof, it has a...
Oh, I forgot about that. Actually, it's on the register. That's the one Alliance Coffee is in, yeah?
Yeah, it used to be there.
I forgot about that. But it is sort of a different style. That one has a hip roof.
Right. And then the Haunt, I guess, which is too bad. Remember where Glenn had his, the Haunt coffee shop there on King Street, right near the flower shop? Used to be called the Haunt Coffee Shop, but now it's been altered like the last two.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
No, I'm trying. The ones I knew on King Street were the, by University.
Where Glenn Grant had his little coffee shop, and he called it the Haunt.
Where was that?
It was on Mauka side of King Street, right near the, right behind Puck's Alley.
That's still there? No, it's gone, yeah?
Still there, but they just encased it so you can hardly see.
Okay. I thought that they were trying, and then I remember being fencing around there for a while. I thought it was gone.
I think they encased it, but maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they took it down and put up something in its stead. So
yeah, I'm not sure.
It's too bad. That would have been a good one.
Yeah, so with the florist shops that are at the street, they would have been nice.
Well, compliment you on your presentation, Don. Thanks.
You're welcome. Thanks, Bill. Okay, any further questions for Don from the board?
Just curious, Don, what does the interior look like? I haven't been in there in a couple decades. It was pretty ground down and moldy and whatnot.
Yeah, no, it's much more. He's put new floor in, and it's mostly all drywall, the ceiling and things like that. So the single wall is not visible on the interior any longer.
Is there any remaining evidence on the second floor of the residential use, really?
No, essentially it's one large open space. Then they carved out a space for that kitchen I showed you. And there's also a small storeroom they carved out with that they wanted to put a lock on. But yeah, no, there's not, other than just seeing the windows, yeah, which again, it's all been drywalled over.
Right. Thank you.
But again, I think if you go down to Chinatown, the same thing, most all interiors you go into, they're all been redone.
Yeah.
So I think we have to be fairly lenient on that.
I take it the attic was once an attic before they put those windows behind the vent. Is that correct?
Oh, I don't know. That I don't know. Yeah, he didn't mention, I don't think so, Bill, because it's a shed roof. And so you all of a sudden run out of attic space. I guess you could have had a mezzanine up there.
No, I'm just thinking, isn't there a shed? Isn't that section above the residential section?
Wait.
It's like the third story.
Okay, I see what you mean. Yeah. Yeah, it probably was. And maybe, let me look again.
You had one picture showing that one there.
Yeah.
So that must have all been sheetrocked or whatever later.
Yeah, huh? It was. And I'm trying to think, was there a mezzanine there? Did we have to climb up steps to see this?
No. I think this is just the third story level.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, you're right, Bill. We had to climb up a ladder to look into this space. Thank you. I forgot about that. One of the tyrannies of 6 months. Well, actually, we did this in January.
Well, it's confusing on the back anyway, because you reduced the sort of two stories on the back somehow.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's sort of like a mezzanine. But it's enclosed.
Okay, thanks, Bill. Thanks, Don. Any further questions for Don from the board? Okay, any questions from anybody in the audience? Okay, anybody like to make a motion?
I move that we list the Surf and Sea building in Haleiwa on the Hawaii Register of Historic Places under Criterion C at the local level.
Thank you, Matt. Any second? Paul Morgan, second. Okay, any other discussion? Okay, take a vote, please, all in favor of placing the Surf and Sea building on the Hawaii State Register. Looks like it's unanimous. 6 eyes. Thank you, Don.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, that's it for our nominations. We can move on to our other discussions. First would be the draft meeting dates. I think Chandra sent out two different possibilities, and really the difference was adding in an extra meeting. So if I, sorry, I've only printed out one of these, but if I recall correctly, we would be adding in the July meeting. So we would either have 4 or 5 meetings. Is that right?
I added an August meeting.
Oh, okay, sorry, then I printed out them that it has 5. So the option is to add in an August meeting because obviously that's when a lot of our residential nominations come in. Any preferences or discussion for those different calendars?
Hey, Pat. I have no preference.
Okay, thank you, Matt.
I missed that. I'm having a little trouble getting all my email these days. Can you just read out the dates for me, please?
Sure. This would be the meeting date. The first would, so they're essentially the same, but one option adds in to have an August meeting. So those would be Friday, March 25th, Friday, May 20th, Friday, July 15th. And then, sorry, I didn't print out the one that has the August. Chandra or somebody, could you tell me which day in August that was?
That would be Friday, August 26th.
Okay, thank you. And, oh, sorry, I have it on here. And then Friday, November 18th. So we'd either have those 5 meetings or we would eliminate the August meeting. Is that correct, Chandra?
Yes.
Okay.
So could we send those out again, send those out? I didn't get a chance to write them all down. Could you, Chandra, could you send them all out again to us?
Yes, I can.
Thanks.
Okay, so I think what we need to vote on now is whether anybody has any problem with any of those dates, that we could change the date of one of those meetings, and also whether we wanted to have a 5 meeting calendar or a 4 meeting calendar. So whether or not we would want to have the meeting in August or not. So at this point, maybe we'll ask the first question is, does anyone have a preference to the 4 meeting calendar or the 5 meeting calendar? Let's see, Matt, you said you don't really have a preference. Okay. Bill Chapman, do you have a preference whether we have 4 meetings or 5 meetings?
No preference. They all look pretty good to me.
Okay. Pat?
I do have a question that might well be unanswerable, but is there any movement toward our meeting in person and going back to site visits?
No. I mean, we're a long way from, I mean, I think there's a clear trend for increasing relaxation of the restrictions, but I think at this point, it's anybody's guess when we'll be able to do that, or if we'll be able to do it. I will say that, frankly, we cannot afford to pay travel until July 1st at the absolute earliest. Our budget will just not tolerate it. But, you know, it also doesn't look like the government is going to sort of completely relax things that quickly. I'll also point out that while technically there's an option for the board to have hybrid meetings with some people attending in person and some people being online, that we lack, and within SHPTE we do not have the resources to do that, and we don't have those resources available to us. So for the time being, it's all or nothing. It's either in person or online. There's no middle ground for us.
Well, Katie, I think that having scheduling the 5 right now, and by March we should have some idea of the nominations that would stack up for July and August, and You'll have to tell me, but it seems like we could possibly cancel, you know, early on, so that nobody was inconvenienced if it looks like we're not going to need the fifth meeting.
Okay. Dr. Downer, do you agree that's possible? We could at a later date cancel the August meeting if we foresaw that we wouldn't need that?
Sure.
Okay. We just need to make sure that we would do that in time. Okay. And then it seems to make sense that we choose the five meeting agenda. We just need to have, if any board members have any issues with any particular date in particular, it doesn't sound like at this point anybody does, but if you all get a chance to look at your schedule a little more closely and see that there's any concern, then maybe we could discuss that further going forward. Okay, so at this time, would somebody like to make an motion to approve the calendar for the meeting dates?
I move to approve the Historic Places Review Board calendar for 2022.
Thank you, Pat.
Seconded.
Okay, seconded by Matt. Any other discussion? Okay, all in favor of approving the calendar as posted on the website? Okay, unanimous, 6 votes yes. Next item is to add in a limited meeting for the March meeting. So that would be for Thursday, March 24th. Would somebody like to make a motion to add in the limited meeting?
I move.
Okay. For reasons of privacy and no, I forget what I tried to say. Privacy, security, and what is the last thing? Those things.
Okay. Yeah, I'll add those things. That's part of my motion.
Okay, thank you, Bill. Anybody like to second? Okay, Paul Morgan seconds. Great, so we've added in a limited meeting. Next are submitted nominations for the March meeting. Didn't see those listed on the agenda, but maybe Chandra, you could let us know sort of what you see coming up for the March meeting.
Right now, we don't have a number, exact number. Right now, we're looking at maybe like 2 or 3, but we're still waiting for the nominations to come in for the deadline.
Okay. And it looks like we'll have at least one, if not that were deferred from today.
Yeah. Katie?
Yes.
Yes.
I'll have a number of nominations at that meeting. I'm planning on doing a multiple property nomination for the La Pietra townhouses. And then I have one residence in New Uwanu, one residence down at the end of Kapiolani Park, and another residence up in Manoa. So I'll have, and the multiple property will have like 10 or units.
Okay, so we'll have at least 4 from you, Don?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, great. Any other items to be discussed? Dr. Downer, did you want to make any statement regarding SHPD?
Sure, I got a couple things. First of all, I'd like to take a moment and introduce Dr. Mary Kodama, our new staff member who is an architectural historian. She's just come on staff, so we're slowly rebuilding rebuilding our architecture branch. And Mary wants to say a couple words to introduce herself. That's an opportunity for her to do so.
Hi, this is Mary. I just want to say that I am very happy to be part of the SHPD group.
I missed the name, Alan.
Mary Kodama.
Oh, man. Hi, Mary. Welcome. Welcome to the welcome to the family here.
Yeah, you could wave.
Hi again, Mary.
Hi, Dr. Chapman.
Welcome aboard.
Thank you. Mary
is I was on Mary's DR committee, so I'm really pleased to see her coming to work. She's an experienced nomination writer as well.
Glad to be on board.
Thank you. Very great to have you.
Thanks, Mary. So the only other thing I'd like to sort of announce is that we sometime this afternoon we anticipate that the governor will wrap up his consideration of SHPD and the Department of Land and Natural Resources budget. And I have to say, I feel like it's Christmas Day. We've seen the governors, we've seen the budget and finance recommendations on our budget, and I'm shocked. Got almost without exception everything we ask for, and we made an enormous ask. And I'm told the governor personally supports it. So we do have, I feel a bit like a glutton. I'm appealing one of the items that we got that they reduced. They didn't eliminate it, they just reduced it. But we'll see how it shakes out. Of course, we have to convince our friends in the legislature to go along too. But right now, yesterday I was speechless. I had to read the budget four times before I convinced myself that it actually said what it said. So we'll see how it goes. But right now it couldn't look very much better. So, and that's pretty much it for me.
I have a question, Dr. Donner. We have an open position. Is there, right? Shouldn't there be a seventh of us? Is there any move on that?
So we have talked to several people, but the vacant position, the open position is for somebody, must be filled by somebody with cultural expertise, Native Hawaiian cultural expertise. We have talked, we have tried to recruit several people. Whether, as you all understand the process, you have to fill out a nomination, you have to apply. And the governor's appointments office has not told us that they have received any application. So we continue to try to get qualified people to apply, and whether they're applying, and they do have 180 boards and commissions they have to staff. So they don't drop everything when they get one for one of our boards. So far, we have not heard anything from them indicating they have an application that they're prepared to forward to the legislature, or that the governor might appoint on an interim basis. Stay tuned. Watch this space.
Thank you. Good luck on that budget.
Okay.
Is Mary, let me ask a quick question, Alan. Is Mary, I remember writing a recommendation for her. Is she branch chief in architecture, or is she architectural historian?
She's one of the architectural historians.
Okay.
And, while you bring that up, we have a vacant architectural historian position. We have the branch chief position, which is also vacant. We have yet to get applicants for either of those positions. So if you know somebody you think is qualified and would be interested, and encourage them to apply.
Great, thank you, Dr. Donner. Any other questions or comments? Okay, thank you everybody for a very interesting meeting. Wishing you guys all happy and safe holidays coming up, and see you in March. And I'd like to say this meeting is adjourned.
You will, everybody.
Thank you, everybody.
Hui ho.
Okay, Katie.
Great seeing everyone. Wish I could
thank
see
you, everybody.
You meeting.
See you all in March. Have a happy holidays.
Bye. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.